Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May 21st, 2019. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Upada Sutta and the importance of wise associations within Dhamma practice. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
This is the Upada Sutta. I know I say this about just about every single sutta, but this is another very important sutta. And in its own way, because this sutta, the Buddha points out an underlying theme throughout his Dhamma, that who and what we associate with will determine the experience of our life. And as far as Dhamma practitioners, it will determine whether we actually developed the path to its completion or not. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying with the Sakyans in Saqqara. Venerable Ananda had a question for his teacher. He approached the Buddha, bowed, and sat to one side. Is it true that having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues is half of the well-integrated life, meaning well-integrated with the Dhamma, or the Eightfold Path? The Buddha says, don't ever say that, Ananda. Even the Buddha could get excited at times. Having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues is the whole of the well-integrated life. So, of course, the Buddha's not saying that all you have to do is to find a Sangha you're comfortable with and you're good to go. But he's saying that in order to develop the Dhamma, we must have a well-formed, a well-informed and well-focused Sangha. The practitioner of my Dhamma, who has admirable people as friends, and remember, the Buddha's talking about within the Dhamma. He's not putting a judgment on people that aren't committed to his Dhamma. But as far as Dhamma practitioners, admirable people as friends and colleagues can now be expected to avoid distraction arising from unskillful associations and pursue and fully develop the Noble Eightfold Path. What this also means is that we encourage each other to stay this well focused and not get into things we might have heard, you know, on some pop psychology podcast that tries to relate it to Buddhism, or even some other, trying to incorporate another so-called Buddhist teacher, even though they're teaching something that's completely different than what the Buddha taught. It doesn't mean that we don't respect other traditions. And you might even want to dabble in it or just investigate it, and that's fine. But it's paramount to someone who wants to develop the Buddha's Dhamma to focus on the Buddha's Dhamma. Because if we start trying to incorporate anything, really, if you try to adapt, accommodate, or embellish the Buddha's Dhamma in any way, the entire Dhamma is lost. It's hard to understand until we really get to understand the nature of a mind that is rooted in fabrication will continue to fabricate its experience. So the Buddha taught this very narrow Eightfold Path so that we could recognize and abandon fabrications, not create ever more fabrications out of our embellished Dhamma practice.
Could you read that one more time, please?
Certainly. Thank you for asking. The practitioner of my Dhamma, who has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, can now be expected to avoid distraction arising from unskillful associations and pursue and fully develop the Noble Eightfold Path. So you could read this another way, in my own words. The practitioner of my Dhamma, who does not have admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, cannot be expected to avoid distraction. Again, I'm emphasizing the point I just made, maybe too much, but it is, if we are associating with people or practices that contribute to distraction, we're going to have distraction. And it's just that simple. So people can be well-intentioned, well-informed. They might be members of our own family or close friends. It just means they're practicing something different. The Buddha continues, listen carefully, Ananda, and I will tell you precisely how a practitioner of my Dhamma, who has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, avoids distraction and pursues and fully develops the Noble Eightfold Path. This Dhamma practitioner develops right view that is dependent on seclusion, dependent on dispassion, dependent on cessation, that results in relinquishment. That's a pretty straightforward and forceful statement, isn't it? This Dhamma practitioner develops right view, and developing right view is dependent on seclusion or and a proper jhana practice. It's dependent on developing dispassion. It's dependent on cessation that results in relinquishment, cessation of all views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Nothing else is going to work. We can incorporate a lot of different practices, whether it's within a Buddhist practice or not, trying to fix the results of ignorance rather than actually addressing ignorance. And again, that's why it's so important to be well focused, because we can certainly lose track easily if we don't have that a well focused Dhamma practice supported by a well informed Sangha. This past retreat was really remarkable in many respects, but one of them was we had two new folks, and they both commented at different times how important it was, how significant it was, how meaningful it was to them to have not just the world's greatest meditation teacher, but the world's greatest Sangha to support. I'm kidding a little bit. To have this, the words were this warm and welcoming and well-focused Sangha. Just the energy that we carried as a Sangha made both of them very, very comfortable and open to what we were doing. Rather than having some kind of manufactured, put-together Sangha that's doing something new every week and not really addressing the Dhamma. Then it becomes a Dhamma by current topic rather than this Sangha that the Buddha teaches is so important. Someone just walked in. Can we help you?
Yeah. Matt?
Matt's not here, but you can come in.
Oh.
You just want to see Matt, or were you looking for the meditation clip?
Looking to meditate with you guys.
Come on in. You're in the right spot. What's your name?
Peter,
it's a pleasure to meet you. We already meditated, and I'm in the middle of giving a talk, but... Pardon me?
You told me that there was a meditation and a talk?
Yep.
Okay.
All right. You missed the meditation tonight, but we're in the middle of the talk. And just hang around a little bit afterwards, and I'll get you a little bit more acquainted with what we're doing here, but I'm glad you joined us.
Thank you so much.
This talk is on... just so you know what we're doing here, I teach meditation and mindfulness within the framework of something called an Eightfold Path. Do you know anything about Buddhism?
No, I do not.
Good. You're perfect, really. I'm so glad.
Answer.
Just so you know what I'm talking about.
Open mind.
This guy we called the Buddha, his name was Siddhartha Gautama. Upon his awakening, he started teaching. And he taught a lot of different suttas that all relate to one very basic thing, which is ignorance of something called Four Noble Truths. And everything he taught was in that context. And I know that doesn't mean much to you because you don't know what that is. But just understand that. And tonight I'm just giving a talk called the Upada Sutta, which is the Buddha's teachings on how important it is to have a well-focused Sangha.
Maybe you should explain what Sangha and Sutta mean.
Peter, do you know what Sangha means? Sangha means a group of meditators. And a well-focused group of meditators is a well-focused group of meditators like this here. What was the other thing I needed?
Sutta.
Oh, sutta. It takes a little while to get the nomenclature, but sutta means simply a teaching from the Buddha. That's all. And please ask me if it's something I say that you don't understand, just ask me to clarify.
Or if he talks really fast.
Well, that's Lorna does that. Lorna has usually keeps a shoe in her hand.
Shoes.
Yeah.
Shoe suit.
I got a leisure suit coming to match.
Zoot suit.
You're really starting to get old when you're putting slippers, but I mean loafers back on instead of... Okay, that's enough silliness. Let me go back to that This Dhamma practitioner develops right view that is dependent on seclusion, dependent on dispassion, dependent on cessation, that results in relinquishment from all views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. They also develop the rest of the Eightfold Path, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation, all dependent on seclusion, dependent on dispassion, dependent on cessation, that results in relinquishment.
Can you slow down?
Yes, yeah. Thank you. This is how a practitioner of my Dhamma, who has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, avoids distraction and pursues and fully develops the Noble Eightfold Path. Again, it's just simple, clear, and direct teachings. The reason why we want to associate with people that are focused on the Dhamma is to avoid distraction. And I can tell you that that was really the issue that I didn't know I had that issue, but while I was studying in all these different schools, my distraction was increasing, but it was increasing in a focused way, meaning I was becoming more and more enamored, up to a point, with these things that I was taught I needed to develop. And they were presented in such a way that they instilled desire in me to get to that point. And if you're listening to what I'm describing, the practices that I was engaged in were encouraging me to be out of my body constantly, always in that speculated state, however it was described, that I'll get to when I'm awakened. The Buddha taught me how to unite my mind and my body and be present for this process of awakening, which is the only way it can occur. It is only through fidelity to my Dhamma that one may know that having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues is actually the whole of a well-integrated life. It is first in dependence on me as an admirable friend. Notice what the Buddha says there. It is first in dependence on me as an admirable friend, not as a god, not as a savior, just as another human being who is an admirable friend. It is first in dependence on me as an admirable friend, that those being subject to birth gain release from being subject to birth, that those being subject to aging gain release from being subject to aging, that those being subject to sickness gain release from being subject to sickness, that those being subject to death gain release from being subject to death. That's the Buddha's initial description of suffering, isn't it? It is in dependence of me, on me as an admirable friend, that those beings subject to sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair have gained release from that sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair, again, release from suffering. From those that have gained release in this manner, from dependence on me, can one know how having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues is actually the whole of a well-integrated life. This also relates directly to the Ratana Sutta, that as Dhamma practitioners, we take refuge in the Buddha, but the Buddha not as a god or savior, but simply as an admirable friend, as a human being who first discovered this. And why is that significantly important? Because establishing the Buddha as one god among many Buddhas, or simply as a god, as a god, maybe a creator god, or some type of god who has the powers to pull strings and grant me awakening, or any other notion we might have of Siddhartha Gautama becoming a superhuman being, once we agree to that, once we buy into that, then we can't do that, can we? We can't really relate to a savior or a god or someone who is superhuman. And so from that point on, from that misunderstanding, his Dhamma is something that is, no matter how wholehearted we may engage with it, our understanding is that it's beyond our reach, that this is something that a god taught. The Buddha understood that because he studied with those types of religions, mostly rooted in the Vedas and the Upanishads. And he was consistent and insistent on presenting himself as simply a human being who figured this out. And now he's teaching everyone else. So we are looking for friends that are just like that. And we become, as we deepen the Dhamma and keep our Dhamma well focused, we become an admirable friend ourselves, don't we? And one of the most remarkable things, and we talk about it a lot, at least I do, but we do talk about it a lot here, is how that's developed here. It is remarkable, and it is fairly unique in the world. It was exampled just so remarkably well over our past retreat because a few things came up in a talk that we had, and I might touch on that, I might not. But you could really see the Sangha coming together and just supporting each other and everything that we're doing. And again, it happens here too. And Peter, I hope you continue to join us because you'll feel that. You'll feel the support of our Sangha, which is so important. Skip over some of my comments. Yeah, I thought that was the end of the sutta. So look how the Buddha concludes this. I'm going to read it again. For those that have gained release in this manner, meaning through the Eightfold Path, from dependence on me, can one know how having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues is actually the whole of a well-integrated life? That's the end of the sutta, so I'll give you the customary bow. Matt and I were talking about this earlier, how every retreat, this was our 10th retreat that we just did, and every retreat has been meaningful. You were on every one, haven't you?
Believe so.
And everyone, you would
believe,
say.
I can't believe.
I can't either. You know, Karen said, just to get off, Karen said they're going to put a plaque up for us because we've done so many retreats there. I said, oh, don't do that, but I hope she does.
Because it is all about us.
It is. Well, I said, how big? That was my question. Every retreat has been meaningful and useful in its own way, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And this past retreat was remarkably meaningful.
Yeah, and it's experience has always been different in every one of them.
Yeah. This retreat, we happen to focus more. I mean, I always bring up right speech as the introduction. That's really what we're doing here. But we focused on it more this retreat than any other. We had a great discussion Saturday night that even impressed one of the monks from Wan Dharma Center sat with us. And I remember... Reverend Park last year, he wasn't particularly interested in what we were talking about. And that's okay, you know. Today, last Saturday, this past retreat, he was transfixed. He was focused on everyone. And he even said something to Karen afterwards about this great talk we had on right speech. So we are doing what the Buddha taught Ananda is the most important thing. And we are all reaping the benefits of it. Now, to get to some specifics, because it's just such a good example. We had a discussion on, well, maybe we should set up why that happened. One of our Sangha members got hurt, and so we had to postpone that. It was Friday night, wasn't it? Or Thursday night?
Friday night.
So, and we had a discussion about that, and the conclusion we came to is that we are a Sangha. And even though it might make the rest of the retreat really compressed for time,
excuse me,
we decided to postpone that and make it up. And then we had a discussion that I think left some people uncomfortable, and I don't want to get into that discussion again, but it was a necessary discussion, and because of this well-focused Sangha, we were able to make it a very important learning example of right speech. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, Kevin came up and he had something very informative and helpful to say to me about that. And then when I got home, there was a letter from David that was just incredibly eloquent in how he captured what occurred there. And the point I'm making about that is how a well-focused Sangha should work. I happen to be the teacher of the Sangha, hopefully not for long, meaning the exclusive teacher. There's going to be some more in training, but that's just my role. I'm just another member of the Sangha, just like you are, just like all of you are. And I need just as much support as you give each other, and you give it to me. That's remarkable. And then we had this great discussion on Saturday night, focused just on right speech. And the remarkable thing about that is, and we call it a mindful social, I think, in our booklet. But it's just that. It's very rare that you're going to get a dozen people, in this case it was 13 people, together eating some great chocolate cake from Anita and not getting lost in conversation and not getting loud in your conversation. Mm-hmm. We had this wonderfully social time, but characterized by that mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And it was an hour and a half or 2 hours of right speech. Did anybody who was there, did anybody feel constricted by the framework of right speech?
No.
Did anybody feel constricted over the entire weekend by being mindful of right speech? Did anybody feel freed from...
You know, constriction than that is to, you know, as a point of focus, it's the best you can do. When you're among people, what better to focus on than the what you say to each other?
Yes.
And yourself.
Yes, and there's great freedom in that. And yourself. When you're with people, it's best to focus on right speech. And when you're all alone, focus on right speech.
Then you're a friend unto yourself.
Then you're be a friend unto yourself, just as the Buddha says. So that's it. I just want to put a little cap or two on retreat. But, Lorna, good to see you.
Good to see you. Glad you're all back safely. And I've enjoyed the talk, but I haven't anything more to say than that. Thank you.
Glad to be here tonight. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to be here. Nice to see everyone again. Thank you for an excellent retreat. It was just really a way to develop more insight on the value of the Sangha and you know, to sort of use that concentration that we were developing for a few days in a row to use that as more right effort into, you know, daily life and to structure the practice with that. And really thankful for that, and you know, really thankful for all the teachings as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Rob, good to see you tonight.
Good to be back in Frenchtown. I just wanted to thank you for keeping the focus in the Sangha for all these years. I realized that even in the beginning years that I came here, that I was probably one of the people trying to pull it off focus. And you kind of changed that thing. You know, got me back in it. No, this is what we're doing here. And I truly appreciate that. There's plenty of distraction out there. Every time I go to, even if I pick up a copy of Tricycle, you know, which is, you know, the thing for Buddhism.
Yeah.
I just get nothing but confusing out of it. It's just, there's this one point of view, and then there's this other point of view, and then there's the third point and fourth point of view, and it doesn't lead to calm.
Somehow you're supposed to wade through all those wrong views and arrive at right views.
Right, right.
Almost
by
accident.
Actually, when you at some point, at my birthday party, you suggested I read some of the Abhidhamma, and I started at it, and it was like, oh my God, why would I do that?
It's brutal. It just twists you up.
It is just every sentence is just, you know, mind twisting stuff. It reminded me a bit of Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's tales to his grandson.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You read one paragraph and you come out, you know, reeling.
It's an example of dukkha, I think, just trying to read it. And yet that's the foundation for one half of modern Buddhism.
Thank you for keeping the focus.
Thank you for being here for all of it. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. Russ and I were talking on the way over about how right speech is such a good launching point for the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
You know, if you can maintain that, it just helps to formulate the way you think, the way you behave, the way you pursue things, the way you prioritize, and it's just a very powerful way to focus your life.
Yeah. Great insight, Helen. Thank you. Yeah, we spend a little bit of time well, I spent the whole retreat emphasizing that the Dhamma is to be practiced right here, right now, at the point of contact between what's occurring and my six senses. And our speech is just that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
If we're mindful of our speech, we are mindful of where we are at the point of contact in what we're saying. And that's why it's so powerful. And it is, for most people, that is the entry point, but also the ongoing direction by being mindful of what's coming out of my mouth, including what I'm saying to others, but most importantly, what I'm saying to myself, is that if I want to know what's going on, what I'm holding in mind, to pay attention to what I'm saying for a little while, you know, maybe for a day or two, if I'm not too sure. But pretty soon I'll realize these are the things that I want because they're coming out of my mouth, whether I'm saying it to someone else, I hate that guy, you know, whatever it might be, or I'm saying it to myself. Be mindful of it. But it takes a well-concentrated mind and the framework to understand that. Matt mentioned something this afternoon that was an insight that he gained. And the way he explained it, I wish he was here, because he understood something very subtle in himself that was unskillful. Yet he didn't judge himself at all. It's simply a recognition of something that's fabricated. Why judge yourself harshly over something that, as a Buddha says, is like foam on the ocean? Just let it go. And that's a calm and peaceful Dhamma practice. We're not here trying to tear at our own soul, because we don't have one, and find out how awful we can be and find out all the things that are wrong with us and then hope that somehow we're going to get better. All that we have to do is recognize that all those views are fabricated and let them go. Nothing to it, right?
Hi, Mary.
Hi, John. Hello, everyone. Thank you for the retreat. There were, you know, so many things we even talked about. Poise, I remember that word was used.
Yeah.
The, you know, the opposite of reacting and experiencing things at the point of contact is, you know, to have poise, and you wouldn't want that, you know, in your life.
Yeah.
I enjoyed this sutta tonight about associations. You know, it just makes so much sense, but it's not always, you know, how we each live our lives or how our children live, you know, their lives as they're making new friends and everything. So it's really valuable experience. So as always, lots of useful discussion. To guide us off our cushions. So lots of effort put in toward skillful restraint in our speech and concentration regarding our practice. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well said. Thank you. David, good to see you tonight.
Just would like to thank you for your energy and your wisdom.
You're welcome. Thank you for yours.
Mm-hmm.
Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I'm going to take noble silence.
I'm glad you're here. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I, you know, sometimes you get an insight and it's you can't even believe that you're hearing something for the first time. And when we talked about wrong speech as eye-making, I thought, of course it is.
Yeah.
And so if you're working towards not putting yourself at the center of everything, and then combine that with right speech, it just all of a sudden, it all sort of comes together. And it's almost as if there's this, because I think once you've been involved in this for a while, we were talking even just when we first came in and sat down, is you start to hear yourself when you're not in right speech,
mm-hmm.
like louder than you noticed it before. You know, maybe before you thought you were just being funny, or you just, you know, had to get it out or whatever. But coupling it together with the fact that you're preserving the false understanding of what ego is, just it, you know, it had a, it was like a like a light came on. And at first I had an existential crisis about it for about, I don't know, an hour.
Wow.
And then I brought it back in and realized, you know, that it's, you just start from where you are.
Mm-hmm.
So
but
it's great.
But it was an existential crisis. Because your existence was...
That's
you know,
right, my existence
that's right.
Was
yeah. Yeah.
At stake.
This thing that I imagine to be Liz was threatened. And so I reacted in the way that I've learned to react when I'm being threatened. And anyway, I thought it through, and through further conversation about right speech, it just fell into place in a lineup of things that you do to maintain knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and the ability to stay on the Eightfold Path. So thank you for that.
Thank you for that, Liz. So the structure of the retreats works.
I think that I love the fact that you and Matt focused on right speech.
Yeah. Well, we always have, you know, but...
But I didn't hear it before.
Well, Matt encouraged
yeah.
me to place more emphasis on
yeah.
it, and he was right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But also, the Sangha was ready, too. I think if I...
True.
If I even did this retreat, I'm going to say last retreat, at least two retreats ago, it probably wouldn't have been so well... engage with,
mm-hmm.
But it was now, and it was.
You've already mentioned it.
Yeah.
As to why we only have silence during our meals.
Yeah, but now it's become to emphasize it. It continues to be easeful, not useful. Easeful, easy, and even the emphasis that I put over the weekend on the point of contact. You probably never heard me say it as much as I did over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But that, now you understand, that coincides with right speech. And so a retreat environment is really necessary to develop something that deeply, you know, and that profoundly. In the simple way that what you just said, someone who is free of eye-making, there's no reason for wrong speech, is there? Because there's nothing to promote or defend. And that's why we engage in wrong speech, isn't it? And wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. Because of eye-making. Because I need something. And I don't care what I have to do to get it. In most cases, that I mean, within reason, for most people, with some people, there's no limitation on getting what you think you want. Thank you, Liz. Oh,
I developed some insight into that, what we were just saying, with what Liz said, and sort of that eye-making and the self-talk, and it provided further insight into not only contact, but really the craving, you know, and it really takes a lot of focus to really, you know, listen, for lack of a better term, or really to zero in on the craving part, because
yeah.
that informs the contact or the need for the right speech, you know. What am I feeling here to need to say something or to feel
exactly.
to get out of this
yeah.
or to get involved in something when that just... occurred to me now, and I think that, you know, it was starting to occur to me over the weekend, but that really, that takes a lot of work to really
mm-hmm.
go, that's
mm-hmm.
a really subtle thing that
it is.
That
mm-hmm.
I don't think, you know, was just lost on me at times before, but as the practice grows, I mean, that's where we really gotta do some work, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to.
And to know it. You're in this way, you're using the Dhamma, the structure of the Eightfold Path, to develop your own personal path in the way that you can. But it's your path, but it's the same path. It's the path that connects us all in this Dhamma practice. You're gaining your insight. And now your insight now fed the whole Sangha. Again, it's just the
crave perfect. Was like a word that, you know, I mean, we would say it often, and we, you know, don't hear it as much when we're not doing Truth or Happiness, but you know, sometimes I recall back in points in my life, people would ask me, what do you crave? And it's like, I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what it means. I don't, you know, I'm starting to get a better understanding of it, but
yeah.
I don't know what I crave. What what's crave, you know?
Craving for continued ignorance is really what it is.
Craving for eye making, you know, yeah. makes more
craving
sense.
Craving for eye making.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
Defending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This thing that
is not me.
Yeah.
It's not mine.
Yeah. And that's that is more, you know, right there is that takes on a whole new meaning as well.
Yeah. Think about this, because you all understand it. Excuse me, Peter. I know you just joined us, but you'll understand this in probably a week or two. Craving for a fabricated life. Craving to live in an illusion for your entire life. Why would anybody want to do it? We wouldn't, except we don't know that we're there.
That's right.
That's what ignorance means.
We don't even know we're doing it.
And we continue to create, getting just to tie it back into the sutta, so we'll find all kinds of reasons that are acceptable to ignore our own ignorance. That's what the Buddha's talking about here. So anything that seems wholesome and helpful and or that a bunch of people are doing it seems like, okay, well, let me try that. But we spend our lives going from one thing to the next, picking and choosing things that we like because it helps us to continue to ignore our own ignorance. But because it's accepted by so many people and done by so many people, we just go ahead and do it. The other thing about this admirable friends that the Buddha is referring to here is there's a responsibility to each and every Dhamma practitioner once they start understanding what you're doing. And that is to have fidelity to the Dhamma, but also be an example of that. Mm-hmm. There's a word in the recovery community, I'm sure you all heard it, it's called enabling. And that can happen in any situation, and it happens often in social settings, whether it's a Buddhist setting or just a political party or really anything, you start having a view of how things should be. And you unite around the view, no matter how fabricated the view might be. And once you go down that road, it's very hard to turn around. Why? Because there's so much influence around you now to keep going. And so as Dhamma practitioners, we have a responsibility to not encourage other people's ignorance by even tacitly approving something. It doesn't mean we need to get in an argument with every modern Buddhist. It just means we should be very cautious about where we show our support, whether it's financial or simply our participation. I'm very careful about where I go now to practice. Years and years ago, I'd go anywhere because they go, wow, this is just Buddhism. You know, I can go anywhere. I like to sit with people, and I did that. But I realized that by me going to a place now, even plunking down my 5, 10, or 15, or 20 bucks, or whatever it is, I'm directly supporting something that I think ultimately continues to pique people's ignorance and continues to hurt people. So I don't do it. I just don't do it. I don't want this to sound like I'm trying to micromanage all your lives, but think carefully about what you support and what you don't. And it's okay to just be neutral about these kind of things. That's the best thing to do.
And even to engage in debate about the relative merits of what you're doing and what somebody else is doing, or what your core beliefs are and what theirs are, even a debate can get you way off track.
And that's where right speech comes in.
Yeah.
Is my word, if my words are going to fall on deaf ears, it's unnecessary idle chatter.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how important, I could be reciting the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. If the person that's in front of me isn't going to listen to it, that's wrong speech.
We're craving to be right in that situation.
We're looking
for them, something to stick.
So the best thing to do is say, I found something that is very helpful. If you want to understand it, I'd be happy to tell you, but not to get into a debate. The Buddha, you know, there's this whole thing in modern Tibetan Buddhism, a certain branch of that, of debate. We've all seen those videos of jumping around and slapping their hands and getting into people's faces. And
right.
And that is their Buddhist practice.
I've never seen that.
Oh, good. Look, just, I think if you just looked on Tibetan Buddhist debate, you'll see plenty of them because it's quite something. But
my first exposure to Buddhism ever, I was in high school, and I happened to see a little, something like a National Geographic movie, and had a little clip in it, and it was like, "Whoa, what are these people doing?"
Yeah, that's their Buddhist practice. I had, like many people, I had this inherent aversion to any kind of conflict. you know. Mm. I mean, that's not a good thing to have either, but I had it. So I imagine if somebody said you had to do this as your Buddhist practice, I wouldn't do it. But the Buddha didn't, he never debated people, but he did get into a structured debate when it was appropriate. You know, there's a lot of suttas like that where the Buddha's debating someone, but look at the setting. They came to him and wanted the debate. They wanted some situations somebody was trying to show the Buddha up, never worked, or sometimes they really did have questions that they wanted to debate. Even the Vajragoda Sutta is a small debate, isn't it? And the setting is important, but it's never appropriate to evangelize or argue with anyone about this. It took me a while not to do that.
That's the way the debate should take place.
Yeah. And an agreed upon setting, not just an argument between two people. So we got a little bit off of that, but that is an aspect of right speech too. And also simply not, Palin, go, please.
I just wanted to add one thing. I heard this on a program on the radio. These two women co-wrote a book, because they knew a lot of people were finding ways to deal with the polarized society we're living right now. And how to be able to have a discussion, whether it's about politics or something else where two people are likely or possibly have opposing views. I think the name of the book was, I Don't Think You're Right, But I'm Open to Listening. Mm. And so it was a gentle way of stating your disagreement, but being open to hearing what they have to say rather than slamming the door, which is what mostly happens.
Yeah. Thank you. The guiding principle as Dharma practitioners for us is right speech. And it really is that simple. And when you read the Buddha, the suttas where the Buddha is in debate with someone, he's always practicing right speech. And that's why he always wins the debate, by the way. But no matter what people are, no matter what someone else might be trying to draw you into, if you maintain right speech, you won't be drawn into it, and then there's a possibility that they might hear what you're saying. But if you start arguing, you know, nothing gets done with that, does it?
Even better, they might hear what they are saying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, that's a lot of...
That's how we learn, too, is when we go on and no one is responding, and you have to hear what you're actually saying, and then you're like, okay.
Yeah, there's a sutta just like that. I can't think of protagonist name, but I'll dig one up and maybe we'll have that next week. So debate suit.
Just a side question. Was the Reverend's story picked up? Did you take that?
I didn't. I wish I did, because that was such a great conversation, the whole thing, but yeah, it was a great talk. A guy, isn't he? He's just so much energy. And
very sweet.
I hear he drives those people up there a little crazy with his energy, but that's their problem, not ours. Russ, good to see you.
Yeah, I was thinking about right speech, you know, I think I'm pretty good with it. For 40 years of being in the corporate world, you know, you better have right speech. I think where it's more eye-opening to me is the stuff I don't say, but I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. About somebody else.
Yep, that's part of right speech.
Myself.
Good for you. Yeah.
So that's what I have to focus on. It's like, I'm not saying it, but I'm thinking it. That's what it's not good, you know, because it's not helping me. It's not, you know, it's just so it's that internal view, which is what I find interesting.
That's great insight. You know, many people that are quiet, taciturn, they might seem like very gentle people, but you get inside their minds and they're just brutal to themselves. One of our Sangha members was talked about that briefly too, that they are very quiet, but not to themselves.
Right.
And they never, and they didn't talk about this over the retreat, but I've talked to them before. And they always consider themselves as quiet, gentle, because they don't get into conflict with other people. But until they started this practice, they realized the tremendous conflict they were carrying around in their own mind. And that was ignored because what they were presenting to the world was wonderful. And it has had a profound effect on this person, just clearing out that internal conflict. Peter, welcome to our Sangha. I know this is probably a little bit over your head, I think, right now, but do you have anything you'd like to say?
No, I choose noble silence.
You learned something.
Nice speech.
Teaching me a little bit.
Oh, good, good, good. On the on my website, becoming-buddha.com, right at the top of the screen, there's a link for new visitors. I would suggest you follow that link. Excuse me, it'll take you to a page that describes what I teach and why. And also on the top of the page is a guided meditation from 5 to 45 minutes. If you want to start with that page and then just start with a 5-minute meditation, it'll talk you through it. But that's the way to start. Start with short periods of meditation. Start learning a little bit of the background. Don't be overwhelmed on the website. There's 500 talks, 400 videos, 250 articles. You take one at a time, that's all. The most important thing, you came at an auspicious day to be part of a welcoming Sangha. So I hope you join us again. I have classes Tuesday night and Saturday morning at 8:30. So welcome to our Sangha. Jane, how are you tonight?
I'm fine.
Good.
I also wanted for a very meaningful retreat.
Good. Yeah, it was. Thank you.
And I feel very fortunate to have such admirable friends.
Yeah, me too. Thank you, Jane. I think that's it. Something I was thinking about, but it can't be all that important. If I think about it again, we'll teach it next week. Anything else from anyone? Okay, we'll finish with metta as we always do. Peter, metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and this is not really a meditation. It's more just a way of establishing goodwill in ourselves for everyone. These are the Buddha. There's a few takes on this. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And just take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And just remain mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
You.
See you, Jane.
Thank you, John.
Bye, Jane.
Bye, Jane.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.